So we're here this time with Sean Ryan, and I'll give you a brief background of Sean. So he grew up in Lackawanna, went to Fredonia and Brooklyn Law, came back to Buffalo area and worked as an attorney for legal aid and doing some other work in kind of that area of the law. He then went on to work at Push Buffalo in the early days of Push and created their development arm, which is still active today in developing properties. And from there into the New York State Assembly, and now is currently in the New York State Senate, and obviously now running for mayor. So I've started off by asking everybody, Sean, like, what's the reason you're running for mayor? Not the brain reason, but your heart and soul. What is it in you that makes you want to do this?
The heart and soul is, the absolute love for the city of Buffalo. I couldn't imagine living anywhere else. I have friends who talk about, well, when we retire, we're going to move here or there or the other where. And I just shake my head and think, well, what do you do there? You got so many friends here. You have so many layers of relationships. The thought of leaving and going somewhere else to start over, even in retirement, it boggles me. But, the other heart part of wanting to be mayor is that, my whole adult life, I watched the city just make knuckleheaded decision after knuckleheaded decision. You would think the people in charge were, against the city of Buffalo. It just never stopped. And so, I always had a mounting frustration. When I was an attorney, I used to sue the city all the time because, they couldn't comply. They would pass a living wage ordinance and then not pay anyone a living wage. So, they would make you, take them to court, to do it. I represented disabled kids, and the city never figured out how to get programming to those kids. So I had to sue the city, in that part of my life. And, then when I worked at Push, starting the development company, you just saw that the city of Buffalo was just hell-bent on bulldozing the west side of Buffalo. And it took a lot of fighting to stop that from happening. But you want me to tell you my origins into sort of politics?
Yeah.
I lived on Ashland Avenue. And at that time, that Ashland and Byrd went the other way. So you could take a right-hand turn off of Byrd Avenue, off of Elma to go on Byrd. And Mr. Goodbar used to have a big ladies' night. And one day a week, our neighborhood would just become like a racetrack because people would get off the 198, drive north on south on Elmwood Avenue, not see a parking spot, take a right on Byrd, right on Ashland, right on Forest, and it would just all night long. So we said, can we do something about that? So we would go talk to our council member, and he said, well, I really can't help you because one of the people who owns the businesses on the corner is active in the Conservative Party. And we just can't really touch that. And we're like, well, we're all homeowners here. We're trying to make our neighborhood better. Oh, no, I can't help you. So we finally kept haunting Mayor Masiello, and they finally put traffic counters down for us. And it was a big victory. It took us almost 2 years to get traffic counters down. And the week after the traffic counters went down, a street sweeper came down. First street sweeper we've ever seen on that block, and it destroyed the traffic counter equipment. And we went back to the city and say, hey, the street sweeper broke this. And they said, ah, what a shame. Come back next year. We'll see if we can budget it for next year. And that's what I said. That's it. Now, I'm mad. You felt like the city was working against a whole new group of, 30-somethings year old who had all just bought houses on the same block, making some, big investments, for us. And that was the city's, response. They didn't want to step on somebody's toes who knew somebody, and somebody else was mad about something else, so nothing could get done. But that's what got me into politics. It was mostly through frustration with the city of Buffalo.
Yeah, I think I can relate to some similar things happening to me about the same time when I had bought my house in the Elmwood Village, and it was all a confusing, muddling battle with the city, it seemed. But I think that's a good way to lead into the next thing I wanted to ask people. So what do you bring to the table as mayor in terms of your experience and just exactly that kind of example that you brought up, which I think a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah. I think I have a lived experience of, you know, spending my life, whole adult life in the city, owning a house in the city, trying to remodel the house in the city, which means you have to get building permits. You know, having my children go through Buffalo Public Schools, try to participate in youth activity and youth sports. And, you know, all along the way, it was hurdles. You know, nothing was easy. And, you know, my wife and I are both attorneys. Like, we're financially comfortable. But even with that, it still makes it hard, you know, to live in the city. So that's, you know, that's sort of my lived experience. But what I bring to the job is that, you know, I spent almost 20 years as a lawyer doing a lot of, you know, public interest law, you know, whether it was suing the city of Buffalo, suing the housing authority for discrimination, suing private landlords for discrimination, doing community development with PUSH, you know, creating a Buffalo neighborhood stabilization company. You know, I had a pretty broad career before I entered public life. So you bring all that with you as a foundation, you know, that you build on. And I didn't even come into public life until I was 46 years old. I ran for election, you know, and it wasn't like I ran for election at 46 because I needed a job. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a career and this was part of my, you know, trajectory. It was a bit of a turn off of, well, you know, doing a lot of good stuff at doing neighborhood stuff on the West Side, and, you know, being a public interest lawyer. And I had a measure if I thought I could get more done in government or to stay sort of, you know, doing, you know, community activist work. And I took the plunge into government, and I'm happy to report that, you know, you can do a lot of good stuff, you know, for your community, you know, getting involved in government, as long as you stick true to, you know, your true North Star, like, you know what you're there for. But coming in as an adult, as having lived experience and professional experience, I think that's really what separates me from the other, you know, candidates in this race. And then I took that and went to the state assembly and the state senate, where, you know, I just learned so much about how government works, how programs work, how the federal money goes to the state, how the state money, you know, goes to the county or the cities, how to get money to go to the counties or the cities. So I'll bring that, you know, with me. And the most important partnership that I'll have when I become mayor is my partnership with New York State. I mean, Buffalo has not taken advantage of New York State. You know, this year, in this year's budget, we approved a $400 million Albany improvement plan. It's because the city of Albany and their business sector and their development sector and their housing people, they all worked for several years on a plan to put huge capital investment into downtown Albany, to put affordable housing into downtown Albany, to put retail. They have a whole big plan. And with that, they were given $400 million. My entire time that I've been in Albany, the city of Buffalo comes down once a year. And each year they ask, as part of their testimony, they asked for money to build a public works park. And each year when they leave, everyone looks at each other and says, the state doesn't fund public works barns. And the next year, the city of Buffalo comes down and asks for the same thing. And this year, acting mayor Scanlon got on the thruway, drove all the way down to Albany, and guess what he asked for? A public works barn. So 13 years of being told no, they keep asking for the same thing. Meanwhile, places like Albany just walked home with $400 million. You know, Rochester has had different financial plans to help them. Yonkers has had different financial bailouts to help them. But Buffalo's got this idea, this, you know, they're rugged individuals, like, they don't need anybody. But that has just led us to having a city with no capital investment into the city itself, but also no money for the city to spend on itself. So, you know, they've really just missed the ball so many times. So in order for Buffalo to get out of this financial mess we're going to need help from the state. But the state's not going to help you until you lay your cards on the table and say how bad your finances really are. But Buffalo is still just hiding their finances. You know, so this year, you know, they have this cockamamie scheme to sell their parking ramps to themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, what even is that? I mean, just the ridiculousness of the first blush of that. I'm going to sell something to myself so I can pay myself the money. And that'll allow me to get out of this year's budget hole. Well, what are you going to do next year? And the parking ramps, P.S., generate $5 million a year in revenue. So you're way better off like refinancing your debt and paying it back with your parking ramp revenues. And they were even entertaining thoughts of selling Kleinhans, selling Shays, selling the zoo. I mean, you know, these are fire sale things only desperate cities do. But we got to get out of our financial mess, but we're not going to get out of our financial mess by, you know, continuing to kick the can down the road with gimmicks of selling parking ramps and, you know, selling, you know, Kleinhans. Like, it's almost laughable that these are actual proposals that, you know, the brain trust in City Hall is saying is going to get us out of our mess.
Yeah, that is one of the things that I want to get to here, the finance part of it. I also have this, I think it ties into a theory I've had for a long time that is that there is an economy, an economics to decline, which is a profitable economics. And I think that that type of, and it's not just Buffalo that's done it, cities, you know, across the country have done it, particularly on the East Coast, of selling their public assets to, you know, to theoretically balance a budget. But, I mean, I guess the most famous example is probably the Ambassador Bridge in Detroit.
Just going to say Detroit. You know, Chicago sold its parking meters.
Right. It's just, so some of this stuff. And but the other
thing. It's right out of the Chicago School of Economics. It's like how Argentina should balance its debt in the 80s. Like, you know, we've seen these before, but we know how they turn out.
Right.
They don't turn out with the municipality being sound economically.
Right.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, the other sort of the profitization of decline is, you know, for the last 20 years, New York State gives the city of Buffalo money to do fix blight and to make repairs. And you know what they did with almost all that money? They just demolished houses with it. So the demolition contractors, you know, were all on board. And those demolition contractors then all come to fundraisers. And then this becomes the norm, is how do we fix our problems? Well, we demolish houses. But there was no step two after the demolition policy. Mm-hmm. So you're going to demolish the houses. Then who's going to cut the grass? What are you going to do on that? There was no step two. If you took all the houses that we demolished, you know, at one point the former mayor, you know, was touting 5,000 houses were demolished in 5 years. If those houses were back on the tax rolls, we wouldn't have a deficit right now. It's like they didn't know or they didn't think enough to realize that every time you demolished a house, you were taking the opportunity for a structure that was paying into the tax rolls off the tax rolls. And to go back to my West Side work, is when we were putting together the plan for the West Side redevelopment, you know, we had big fights with the city, but they finally agreed to do a moratorium on demolitions.
Yeah, I remember that.
And at the time, we didn't really realize how important that was. But all the houses they had the red demo X's on are now filled with people. But unfortunately, the East Side didn't have that opportunity. You know, the demo policy went full steam ahead there. And, you know, this weekend I was walking down Nevada Street and I was talking to a longtime homeowner. A man's been there 46 years. His house was impeccable. And he said, I've been here 46 years. I pay my taxes. I keep my house up. And he said, look across the street, 4 vacant lots. And he named the families who used to live in those houses. And he said, on the other side, I have 2 vacant lots and my other neighbor is 1 vacant lot. He said, I used to have neighbors. Now I have knee-high grass, possums, and raccoons. And he just shook his head and said, you know, this isn't what I bought into 40 some years ago.
Yeah, no, that's real. And the amazing thing about that, and then we'll circle back, get on track, is that I moved to Buffalo in 1992 and I was a paramedic and I was all over the city. And I tell people this and they kind of can't believe it, but I can remember going down Broadway in the early 90s and being on all those streets off of Broadway and it being packed with people. Now, this is not to say that it wasn't a neighborhood that was really challenged and had huge issues and poverty and all this other stuff, That was all true too, but the number of people there and the houses that were still there in the early 1990s is absolutely amazing. The Broadway market in those years was packed, absolutely packed.
And you know why it was packed? Because people could walk there.
People could walk, exactly. There was people there and they went there and you had your little old, there was the African-American community, of course, was the predominant population there. But then there was also still the old Polish ladies that didn't speak a lick of English,
yep,
and could go to the Broadway market and get all their groceries and go home and never learn to speak English.
We recently did with Reverend Mark Blue from the NAACP. What's that group who comes in from the outside? They bring architects and engineers and like do a study of your area.
You would know. I can't.
ASI. Anyway, they came in and did like a 3-day charrette on Jefferson. And the first thing that, in their presentation was, everybody here wants Jefferson to be a vibrant commercial area, like neighborhood retail. But our study of the streets leading into Jefferson shows massive vacant lots. Mm-hmm. You cannot support a residential commercial area unless you have residences.
Right.
So anytime you think about, well, we need to get businesses on Jefferson, step one needs to be, we need to fill in all the vacant lots on the streets leading to Jefferson. And that's why the state program, that I put together for 2 years in a row to put infill housing, in the vacant lots. I'm not talking areas by the central terminal, where it's greenfield. But I'm talking like Glenwood Street with 3 vacant lots on one block and 2 on the next. We have a program that'll allow you to build a brand new single or a double for people who make between $40,000 and $90,000 a year. So you go to the bank, if you make $50,000 a year, the bank will give you the mortgage based on your salary. The state will put in a subsidy to match the rest of it. And 1/30th a year is forgiven for 30 years. So, that helps remedy, some of the redlining that was done, some of the banking discrimination that prevented people from buying homes in that area, but allows money to be funneled back into those areas to allow, our Black brothers and sisters who were denied housing opportunities for generations, the ability to generate generational wealth. And at the same time, that's how you get your commercial strips going.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, businesses need people. So I'm going to circle back to one of the things you started on, which I think is important, and it comes up with probably everyone in Buffalo at some point, is there's this, people have a feeling of a very adversarial relationship with government in general. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's not just Buffalo, but it's one of the things that I think frustrates everybody here, because you have all of us have more of a connection or more of a relationship with local government than we do with higher levels of government. So today's day one, you're the mayor. What's the first thing that you're going to attack, and how do you plan on addressing it?
Yeah, so it's really the basics. So people in Buffalo, they're cued in. They'll have on their refrigerator who their county legislator is, who their council member is, and they'll call those numbers. But right now, we haven't been able to give the basics to our citizens. Like stuff we used to do, we just don't do anymore. We don't plow our streets regularly. We don't fix our potholes. We don't pave. We don't have a plan for putting sidewalks back in. Our pools are open some years, and some years they're not. And our community centers are falling down. So if you can't deliver the basics to your citizens, the relationship's going to be fractured. I mean, anytime I go to any community meeting, people joke about 311. How many times I had a call to get something to happen. But often the something they wanted happening was like picking up trash that was never picked up, or coming after somebody illegally dumped, or there is a car without license plates that somebody left on my street. But those are the basic functions of government. And we haven't been able to deliver those. So we have to go back to having a standard of excellence in City Hall. Any interaction you have with City Hall, you should have an A-plus reaction to that. You come into City Hall to pay a fine, pay a ticket, pay your taxes. It should be a smooth, seamless experience. And everyone working in City Hall should know their number one job is to make sure that the customer, the citizen, has a positive experience with that. You know, often you might not, you got to tell people something they don't want to hear, but it doesn't mean it has to be a negative experience. I've done a lot of work with small business owners who will just tell you, you know, the amount of work, you know, that it took to open the bookstore on Grant Street, the amount of trips downtown because they had to, she had to put a new heater in and some plumbing and, you know, up and down the elevators and come back tomorrow and come back the next day. So we announced one of our programs today is we're going to have a series of liaisons. So if you're a small business owner coming in looking to start a business, you're going to be signed an individual liaison. And that person is going to be like the bureaucracy buster for you. They're going to take you to the different departments to make sure you seamlessly get your permits. And we don't make people just wait forever. So that's the kind of thing. So the day one is really realizing, you know, we need to provide services. That's our goal. I represent the town of Tonawanda also. And every time I spend time with your municipal government, I'm amazed is there's politics in Tonawanda, just like anywhere else, right? You want to get a job in Tonawanda? It probably helps that you know somebody. But knowing somebody there is going to get the door open for you. But when you come in for an interview, they're going to say, it's really nice that your aunt is so-and-so. She got you this interview, but only you can keep this job. And if you're not performing, you can't stay in this job. So they really have that attitude. I was up there once doing a press event, and there was a small fender bender. Tow trucks came. And the police department wouldn't let the tow truck driver leave with the car hooked up until they swept up the glass in the road. Could you imagine in the city of Buffalo, something like that happening? But why not? Why can't we have that? You know, I think we deserve better in the city of Buffalo, and I'm going to make sure we get better.
One topic that everybody's talking about, and so we're going to have to ask the question, and then I'm going to follow up with some of my thoughts and maybe direct it in a different way. But the 33, that is the, you know, that's the thing that's on everybody's mind. So can you state your position on the 33?
Yeah. So the 33 joins a long litany of the Skyway, the 198, of projects that have been failures. And they've been failures because there's been no city leadership. I tried to do the 198 as an assembly member and as a senator. Well, it's still not done. Brian Higgins, as a Congress member, tried to, you know, fix the Skyway. And Crystal People Stokes has been trying to fix the 33. But that's not our role. So right now in Rochester, Syracuse, and Albany, each of those cities is going through the same thing we are, is trying to figure out what to do with the Moses-inspired highways in their cities. But each of the cities, guess who's leading the process? Not the state DOT from Albany, but the mayor's office. The mayor's office in Rochester is leading the interloop step, you know, phase two project. The mayor's office in Albany is trying to figure out what to do with the 787 along the river. And the mayor's office in Syracuse is trying to figure out what to do with that massive viaduct going through town. But the city of Buffalo, they just lay in the weeds and they don't take part in these decisions. And then at the end of the day, what happens with the Kensington? It wasn't a good community engagement process. The state never looked at all the alternatives they were supposed to look at. You know, they should have looked at a tunnel. They should have looked at a full restoration of the parkway. And they should have looked at, you know, the cap along with any negative health consequences. But they just skipped all that. So they went to court and, you know, the court took the state to the woodshed and said, you know, you did it all wrong. So the golden opportunity we have now is now they have to go back and consider all these alternatives to figure out what's the cost of all these alternatives, what's feasible, but also then to really allow the community's full voices to be heard on this project. And I don't think the community's full voices were heard on this project. So I made it my job. I tried to put a meeting together on this to see if I can figure out what people are thinking. I had 15 people in the room. I stopped the meeting at person number 8 because there was 8 different opinions. And so I figured out, well, let the community coalesce with some guided conversations. But in the meantime, we got to make sure that $1 billion that was allocated stays in Buffalo. So I joined forces with Senator April Baskin. And in this year's budget, we made sure that that $1 billion is here. So when the community does come to a consensus, that we're ready to go on it. But if I'm mayor of the city of Buffalo will be lead agent on the Kensington project. The city of Buffalo will be lead agent on the Skajakwata process. And that's how you're going to get things done. If not, it just isn't going to work. And we're going to be back to where we are. And 10 years from now, we're going to be talking about this still.
Yeah, one of my observations or my feelings about all of this and all these different projects that you mentioned is they're always treated as a isolated thing. That this is the thing we're working on now, and this is the thing we're working on now, and then none of them happen. And to me, it's to really figure this out, it has to be deciding what are we going to do with all of the transportation in the city of Buffalo, like
You're absolutely right.
And the 198 and the 33 connect. There's not one project without the other.
How could you say that we're going to do those as two distinctly different projects?
It's the same project.
It's like trying to fix a teeter-totter, but to say, oh, no, one end, it's got nothing to do with the other end of the teeter-totter. I mean, it's a fallacy. Like, you don't know when you're driving. Like, oh, if you're at Delavan and, you know, the 30 at the in the 198, that's not part of this project. But as soon as you cross Delavan, but how do you figure out the 198 if you don't know how many cars are coming into it from the 33? And how do you figure out the 33 if you don't know how many cars are coming from the 198?
And then I think it goes to an even broader level that we've got to figure out, like, where does all this traffic go? And one of the things, you know, you go to other cities, like we're in Nashville frequently.
Cities without taxi stands?
Yeah. But cities that have had clearly, like, really serious traffic studies and traffic planning done, that even on busy streets, that at a certain time they go to flashing amber and traffic moves so much quicker. And you compare that to, like, you know, ask anybody that's lived in Buffalo for any period of time longer than about 2 weeks, and they will complain about the traffic lights on Main Street, for example. So, like, part of alleviating this bottleneck to me is taking the whole traffic system of Buffalo and looking at it as one thing, which it really is.
That's a brilliant observation, but it's also like elementary planning, right? You got to look at all these things together. I mean, Pittsburgh went to synchronized lights 20 years ago. Not synchronized lights on Oak Street, like where, oh, you can hit them all at once. Mm-hmm. But they're smart lights. Like, you know, it'll turn amber after a certain period of time unless the traffic upticks. Then it'll turn back to a regular street light. But, you know, right now there's street lights on Delaware Avenue on Main Street that they just turn on a cycle. So 2:30 in the morning when there's no one on the road, there's a red light. And there's no reason, you know, for that red light except that they're using technology from 1950. That, you know, that's the only reason. But when we did the review of the 198 with Hal Morris and the Greater Buffalo Regional Development, I was GNRBTC. You know, he approached the whole question from a different way, and it was, what do you expect out of this roadway? And what do you expect out of this roadway project? As opposed to just looking at it straight from the traffic perspective. And, you know, from that, you know, people said, well, I would like to be able to get to work, you know, quicker. Right now, it takes me a long time to get to work, so I have to drive around the 198, you know, to get to work, or I have to drive around the 33. I live on Northland, but I have to drive all the way around to get across, you know, Northland. So kind of looking at it that way, what do you expect to happen if we do all these changes, you know, to the roadway? I think that's a way better way to look at traffic problems from the get-go is, well, what do you expect to happen if we change this road? You know, because people always have these mystical things like, oh, all this economic development's going to happen if we change this intersection. But they don't call in, you know, land use people at the front end to say, well, if this intersection looked like this, what would happen? Mm-hmm. You know, instead, you know, there's always sort of strange Santa Claus-like promises that go along with major infrastructure projects.
Yeah, a lot of pretty pictures with park benches and things like that that may or may not materialize.
Yeah, but we have a lot to do in that, you know, that, you know, we have the 190 running around the river, right? That used to be part of Riverside Park, used to be on the river, mm-hmm. but we have that throughway there. You know, we have the 33 coming through, you know, the heart of the east side of Buffalo, you know, taking out an Olmsted Parkway. And then you've got, you know, the 198 coming through a park, and but then really isolating, you know, a big part of the, you know, Black Rock community.
Yeah, and even the, you know, the 33 connects to the 190 via Oak and Elm, which to me is essentially a highway. You know, it may have traffic lights on it, but it's really a highway.
Yeah, and a lot of it was like, that was all imagined before we had the 290 going around, mm-hmm. you know, the city. I mean, just as we were getting done with the 33, the 290 was coming on board. And it turned out to be, oh, I guess we didn't really need that because mm-hmm. we already have our circle highway going around.
We started to get into this so already, which is the, you know, the fiscal crises and state of the city that are, I would say, have been the narrative for the whole time I've lived here. And so you already brought up the parking garage thing, so we know how you feel about that. And some of the other ways that have, and it's not just Buffalo. I think we've all recognized this in governments when there's a need for money, there's, you know, fees go up and there's more fines for this and that. And that's a way of generating more revenue. But again, as you brought up, these are all like short-term fixes. So how do you see, you know, first off dealing with these immediate issues and then long-term creating a plan to get Buffalo so that we're not constantly talking about our finances?
Yeah, so, you know, New York State's not perfect, but the whole time I've been in state government, you know, we've had rational, balanced budgets. So we come up with 5-year revenue forecasts. We come up with 5-year expenditure forecasts, and we monitor those every quarter to see, oh, revenue's down. Well, do we think it's going to stay down, and will other revenue sources, you know, come up, or do we have to change our expenditures? But the city, they don't have any sophisticated budgeting. You know, they just try to get quarter to quarter. They're not looking at what they think the revenues are going to be in 5 years from, you know, commercial, you know, versus property, versus fines, versus events. No clue. And then their expenditures, you know, they fib on them all the time. So we're left in a chaotic situation. You know, most consumers balance their checkbooks in a way better rational manner than the city of Buffalo does his finances. So you have to be honest. And the first thing I would do is I would bring in, you know, the state comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, and say, have at it. Like, you know, tell us what our expenditures are, you know, tell us what our revenue forecast should be. You know, we need to put the training wheels on so we can get a rational system that we stick to, regardless of who the council president is, regardless who the comptroller is, regardless of who the mayor is. But, you know, that's just a process. But we don't like processes in the city of Buffalo. You know, we don't have a 5-year plan for how we're going to pave streets. You know, we don't have a 5-year plan for sidewalks, and we don't have a 5-year plan for our finances either. So, you know, all these answers that we're striving for, they're out there. They just need leadership with maturity to be able to actually, you know, execute and implement these things. you know, you got to think more than just a year ahead, or am I going to get elected again? But we don't have to look far, right? All the towns around us suddenly somehow have balanced budgets. You know, Mark Poloncarz has managed to keep a balanced budget in Erie County since he's been elected. You know, up and down the thruway, sure, every city's got some woes, but no one's got woes like Buffalo does. So the situations we face are not uniquely different than Rochester, Syracuse, and Albany, but our reaction to them have been uniquely different. And it's what's been uniquely different is bad leadership, afraid to give people sometimes, you know, a hard message of this is what we need to do if we want to continue these, you know, programs. But instead, and we've all seen it, right? We've just had a gradual tapering off of things that the city does for its residents. And it's been tapering off because we don't have the money to pay for anything. But we don't have the money to pay for anything because we don't really know what our revenues are going to be year to year, and we don't know what our expenses are going to be year to year. So it's the answers are there. It's whether or not you have the leadership to put those answers in place.
One of the things I've been interested in is the whole system of property taxes and property taxation. And I don't know if there's been some economists that have talked in the last few years of about that, you know, that property taxes are some of the most regressive forms of taxes out there. And then you look at a city like Buffalo, and we hear the term like shrinking tax base, you know, is the term that gets used for cities like Buffalo. And I'm curious as to if there's been any kind of study or work, or like, what is it? What is the percentage of property in Buffalo that's not on the tax base? And you talked about creating new houses in some ways, like how do we really start to reverse that trend?
So, you know, a few things, right? So property taxes may not be the most equitable and progressive, but the user fee is the most regressive fee you can have in a city. And we've been balancing our budgets on the user fee for almost 20 years now. We give away a lot of tax abatements in the city of Buffalo. So almost any of the new construction you see in the city of Buffalo, they're not going to pay taxes, you know, for a decade. A lot of these programs are just aimed to benefit certain people. You know, Carl Palladino and Ellicott Development get tens of millions of dollars of our tax dollars every year. The reason we have a shrinking tax base is because Carl Palladino and his cronies don't pay taxes. And you see in this election cycle, the tens of thousands of dollars they are putting into the election. They're not giving me any money, but they're giving money to other candidates because they want to maintain the current system. And the current system is poor people pay their taxes, but connected MAGA developers and their cronies don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of why I would say I think that the whole property tax system needs to be looked at, because to me, if you
look at the whole thing needs to be looked at, but the fact that you're taking certain commercial property owners and saying you don't have to pay, well, that you don't have to look too far to say that's a bad idea.
Well, that's exactly what I mean, is if a project needs a tax abatement to work or anything, like, then the whole system doesn't work, because what you're doing is exactly what you're saying is you're putting the tax burden on average homeowner. And and so you have at two ends of the spectrum, you have the large buildings and large projects, which are not paying taxes. On the other end, you have, you know, obviously there's all the city owned property, the vacant lots and all that stuff that's off the tax rolls. You have,
you know, add in the nonprofits, the hospitals.
And so there's a huge portion of the city at two ends of the spectrum that are not on the tax rolls. And then the people that have owned their house for 40 years on whatever street, or new homeowners or whatever,
Nevada street, they're
paying for it. So
I think, you know, that's something, you know, we definitely have to look at. But also there, you know, it can be very complex, but it can also be, you know, very simple.
Yeah.
You know, we shouldn't be giving away tax abatements because you give political donations. You know, we can solve that pretty easy.
Well, the last question I want to ask you, can you name, you know, one other city or another sort of leader at that gives you that you think has done something successful or interesting that sort of inspires you?
Yeah, Pittsburgh and Montreal. You know, Pittsburgh and Montreal were both a lot like Buffalo. Pittsburgh, of course, you know, deindustrialized steel plant city. There's no evidence anymore that there were ever steel plants in the city of Pittsburgh. It's totally remarketed itself, made itself. I used to go down to Pittsburgh for vacant and abandonment conferences, but Pittsburgh eventually stopped hosting the conferences because they didn't have any more vacant and abandoned properties. But they would say to us when we came down there, they would say, "What happened to Buffalo? The city of Buffalo doesn't even send people to these conferences anymore." And then, you know, Montreal was another turnaround story, right? So they got deindustrialized. And also because of the Quebec secession, a lot of the financial markets all moved to Toronto. So Montreal had to redefine itself. And now Montreal is a, you know, northern city that embraces the summertime. Their Allentown area has streets closed off during summer months. You have open container laws lifted in certain areas. Music playing, picnic tables put out there. Bike lanes put in, but only for 5 months a year. And the snow falls, they take their bike lanes out. Summer comes, they put them in. Every bar, restaurant all has porch patios they put out on a certain day, and they take them in on a certain day. But they did that because they had city leadership that helped that happen, as opposed to city leadership telling you, no, 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 no. So there's a lot we can do in the city of Buffalo. But a lot of it just takes, could you just get in your car and drive down to Pittsburgh and see what they're doing and see how, you know, they run their city? Because, boy, you know, we can just copy a lot of stuff.
And if you ever want to get, you know, get sucked into YouTube videos, watch snow removal YouTube videos in Montreal.
I have.
Their system is pretty amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah, their Jefferson, their Elmwood, their Grant, they come down and they take the snow away.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Like the next morning at 8 a.m., you're parking next to a clean curb.
Yeah.
Crazy. All right. Good seeing you.
Thanks, Sean, for coming on.
This is great.
Hope it's again.